those are the hard ones. I mean, I've had other investigations that are more just like you stop the car and they're obviously hammered and there's no real struggle of am I going to be able to prove that this person's impaired, because it's like you walk up and he's slurring his words and he can't even and then, you know, you open the door and the bottle of beers fall out of the car as he's getting out of the car and you're like, oh well, all right, this guy's drunk, like let's just go to the jail.
Hey guys, if you missed out on the last conference in Nashville, Tennessee, you don't want to miss out on the next one. It's April 28th through May 3rd, Orlando, Florida, the Gaylord Palms Resort and Convention Center. You made a mistake missing the last one. You don't want that to happen again on this one. 5 days of some of the best training you're ever going to experience packed into one event. We have an early bird special right now, $50 off. Use 24 early bird on our website, streetcop.com. Look for the conference, click the link, register today. If you want to get significantly better at this profession in 5 days, don't dare miss out on the 2024 Street Cop Conference. 111, 110.
Street Cop.
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Benito, and we have with us one of our newer instructors. And I'll let him give his bio in a second, but I appreciate you being here today. Came all the way from downtown, gorgeous Las Vegas. We met almost 2 years ago now when he hosted our training in the metropolitan area. And you don't have to say what agency you're from. Probably the best bet, best course of action. So tell everybody who you are and some of your bio, where you grew up, how you ended up in Vegas.
So basically I started in, I grew up in Alaska, actually. I grew up in Anchorage, Alaska. And then my family said, hey, we're moving to Vegas. And I was 15 at the time, so there wasn't really much of a choice in the matter. So I just grew up there, or, you know, came to Vegas. And then I've always wanted to be in law enforcement. So I started out in the Las Vegas area, working there. I've been working for about 7 years in law enforcement in Vegas, which I've been told kind of amplifies your time because Vegas is a crazy place where
it's nuts, right?
All sorts of things happen all the time. And then when I first started, I kind of was just learning as much as I could learn, kind of learning as many things as anybody would teach me. And I had a more senior guy. He was like, hey, figure something out that you like to do and stick with that, because I was kind of all over the place. So then I got into the DUI business, and that's kind of been my passion since, and got into the everything that I could learn about the DUI-related world, and then built the class that I now teach.
Yeah, and obviously you're a DRE as well, correct?
Yes.
So what's the name of the class, and what is it about?
It's DUI Investigations and Convictions, and basically what it's about is the way that I built the class is to pair the drug world to the alcohol impairment that everybody is used to seeing, and then how to articulate impairment based off of just the little standardized field sobriety test that everybody knows how to do. And then if you have a ride, how to put that all together in a report that makes sense and easy to read, as well as talking to either the subject or your DAs and building rapport, how to communicate with people in a way that actually makes sense to get like a solid investigation, so that when you do finally do your DUI investigations, and you could easily get convictions instead of the stuff that I've seen where either they do a bad investigation or they don't do the field sobriety test properly, or they don't do any investigation at all. And then they are like, well, why is my arrest not going through? Why am I not getting convictions? And I'm like, well, it's kind of simple. You actually have to talk to people and ask questions. And when you don't ask questions, then you don't get answers, and so on and so forth.
So let's go back for a second. What was it like growing up in Alaska and then going to the desert?
So growing up in Alaska, it's the big city there is, you know, population 200,000 people, which compared to Vegas with like 3 million people, that was the first big culture shock. The cool part about Alaska is that, you know, it's small town, so that you can talk to your neighbor, everybody knows everybody. If you need to borrow salt or whatever the thing is, then it's not a problem. Whereas in Vegas, no one knows anyone, and you don't know. I lived in an apartment when I started living on my own. I lived in an apartment. There was 20 apartment buildings. It's one building. up and down, I knew two people in the whole place. The first was the person that was the owner of the establishment, and they live there because they live in to keep eye on the apartment. And the second person was like my next door neighbor who worked the same shift as me. Other than that, I knew no one, which for me was weird because coming from a small town where you kind of know everybody and you have an idea of who everybody is and what's going on and all of that, to the place where you don't know anyone, it was really weird. And then the other thing that was super weird too was, well, or not weird, was the weather change. Cause I went from, you know, negative degrees to 130, and that really was a shock.
How long did it take you to get used to that?
I'm still not.
Really?
Yeah. I'm now been there for probably 14 years. And I'm still the 130 in the summertime. I can't get used to it. I'm used to all the other year-round weather, but the summertime and the blaze of the summer is something I still have to accommodate to.
It's hot, dude.
It's hot, yeah.
I was in Scottsdale in August, and obviously it's the same.
Yeah.
Same heat, same desert, same dirt.
Yeah.
And my brother-in-law was telling me that the pavement at night is like 250 degrees.
Yeah.
It's like walking around in an oven.
Yeah, and then you have people who go and walk their dogs. And it's like, hey, you got to have, like, that's, they have the mitts.
Yeah.
That they have little, like, ice mitts here. They have the heat mitts to absorb the heat on the roadway because it's just so hot.
Dude, it's wild.
Yeah.
It is hot. I mean, you're walking around at night, it's 100 degrees.
Yeah. Yeah.
At night, which is unheard of pretty much anywhere else.
Oh, that's why, like, a lot of the times, so we have, in my agency, we have 6 month shift bids. So you will have a bid for, so what we have some people do is like, kind of like the snowbird. So they will, during the summertime, they will be on graveyard. And then during the night or during the winter, they'll go back to day shift. And so that they can basically accommodate to the weather.
Yeah. Are you one of those people?
No, I was on swing shift for 5 years. And then I went back. I actually just went back to graveyard because I was looking for something different, and I didn't want to get burnt out. So I was like, I gotta do a change. I gotta have something different, and it was the best move I made. I mean, the hours are crazy, but because it's 10 p.m. to 8 in the morning,
it's tough.
It's something. It took some getting used to, but it actually works out better for my family because I'm actually seeing my family. Where swing shift for us is 2 to midnight, and 2 to midnight you don't. You can't have dinner. I mean, right. Yeah, you could have breakfast maybe if you wake up early enough to have breakfast.
Right, right.
But 2 to midnight doesn't actually mean 2 to midnight. 2 to midnight means 2 to 2 or 2 to 4 because you get a later rest or whatever.
Yeah, so, dude, for sure.
Or 10 p.m. to 8 in the morning, you can get off at 8 in the morning because...
10 to 8's a weird time.
It's
dude.
Weird, but...
What do you guys work, a 4 on, 4 off?
4 on, 3 off.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
So you get steady days.
Yeah.
You don't switch ever.
Yeah, so I work Wednesday to Saturday is my schedule, so I get, you know, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday off, which is a nice break.
Do you actually get, like, Saturday night off into Sunday?
So, no, so I actually get... I technically have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday off if you look at it on paper, because I get off Sunday morning. So I get off Sunday morning, I come in Wednesday.
That's kind of stupid. Why don't they just, and again, I'm not going to criticize your agency, but like, why don't they just make the Friday and Saturday the split so everybody gets a piece of the weekend?
I think the reason they did it that way was because coverage-wise, they were having issues with having enough people on the weekend. And so there wasn't enough people that would work the weekend on how they had it originally split. And so instead of dealing with that, they just made the days off weird. So we have 4 squads, and each squad has different days off. So the squad 1 will have Saturday, Sunday, Monday off. Squad 2 will have Sunday, Monday, Tuesdays. 3 will have Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And then 4 will have Thursday, Friday, Saturday. So then it rotated enough to make it for them.
You could always bid off the shift in 6 months anyway if you want.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And I can have whatever shift bid that I want because I have enough seniority on my department to go wherever I wanted.
So tell me about some of your more memorable DUI investigations and why they're so important.
So, I mean, I've had a lot of DUI investigations, obviously, working in the Las Vegas area. There's no shortage of people driving under the influence. But I would say, because being a DRE or a drug recognition expert, I do all of the fatal crashes, so anything resulting in substantial bodily harm or death is the cases that they have me work. So I've worked some cases, like one case that comes to mind right now is I had a case where he was going 98 miles an hour and then went straight into a crash attenuator, rotated and killed his back passengers, and then severely injured somebody else because they like broke his like femur.
Wow.
And so I get on scene and he's up talking, no problem at all, because he's drunk and high. So I go, and after he's done filling out his statement, I bring him over to the car, separate him from everybody. And then I do the DUI investigation. He does the whole thing, all the field sobriety, and he has obvious clues and indications of impairment. I get his blood work back. He was drunk, high on meth and marijuana. So, and then, you know, I ask him where he's coming from, and he's coming from a local club, which that local club is known to have the drugs that he was under the influence of. So it's just the reason that I'm so passionate about the driving under the influence is because I've seen so many people get killed or injured, to include law enforcement officers. And I just want to try my best to eliminate it to the best of my ability. And then I that's why I made the class, that I could show the importance of these. Cause I know the heartache or the struggle with the DUI investigations, cause it's so much paperwork for a misdemeanor crime at the end of the day. And so I knew some of the struggles or some of the issues that we have with the process, and I wanted to help alleviate some of those, or the ones that I could.
What happened to that guy?
So that guy went for, I believe he got 20 years for his, and he killed the friends in his car. So he killed two people in his car. He got 20 for the first person, and then I think he ended up getting 20 for both. Like they merged. That was the deal.
Yeah.
So he got that, and then so now he's in prison.
Yeah.
And then I've had others, other fatals. Like I had one where the guy drove wrong way, and then he killed a family.
Wow.
He had two people killed. So he killed mom, dad, and sister, and there was two babies that stayed alive, thank God. The first one was, so the first one had a traumatic brain injury, so he's doing better now. And then the second one, she broke her arm, but she remembers everything. So the trauma that she had to experience, and she's five, so she'll remember it. And
wow.
So the trauma for her. And he was high on fentanyl, and so I remember doing that. He got 20 per life, so he'll be in prison for a while.
Yeah, that's terrible, dude.
Yeah, and those are the hard ones. I mean, I've had other investigations that are more just like you stop the car and they're obviously hammered, and there's no real struggle of, am I going to be able to prove that this person's impaired? Because it's like you walk up and he's slurring his words and. You can't even, and then, you know, you open the door and the bottle of beers fall out of the car as he's getting out of the car. And you're like, oh, well, all right, this guy's drunk. Like, let's just go to the jail. Or you get the person who's like, yeah, just arrest me. I'm hammered. And
yeah.
And that's the Vegas way.
What percentage of people do you think are driving under the influence after 12 o'clock at night?
I mean, 80%, I would say, because you know, so after midnight or after midnight, especially in like the Las Vegas area, the only people that are driving on the road after midnight are either people who just got off of work, because we since it's a 24-hour town, we have odd
shifts nonstop, right?
Shifts nonstop. So you have the people going home from work, which half of those people are under the influence too, because it's like bartenders or exotic dancers or whatever. And all of those people either drink or use drugs, and then they drive their cars. So you have those people that are impaired, and then you have the people that are enjoying the Vegas experience. And so obviously they're not doing that sober for the most part. So I'd say, yeah, 80%. So if you're stopping cars, you're finding them. And
yeah.
That's what I strive people to do, because it's like, hey, our whole goal is to prevent crime before it affects other people.
Right.
So let's interdict the impaired driver before they kill somebody.
Yes.
Or before they crash.
Yeah, you have to try to quantify or measure how many people's lives were probably saved because of somebody stopping, somebody who's probably inebriated.
Oh, yeah.
We had one so crazy. I can think of a couple in my career that I recall. I was sitting at a light in my town, and through the light turn, like, it was a big intersection, bro. Major highway, three lanes one way. So essentially six lanes, three each direction.
Right.
North and south. And then the intersection had three lanes each way. It's a big intersection, big, broad. And so it's right by our mall. Sit at the light, got sent to a job. Like, just some bullshit paperwork job that nobody wanted to do, right? Some kind of bullshit job. And, dude, like, the light turned red and was red for a while. And this dude came by in a burgundy Mustang and, like, blew the light, like, 14 seconds after the light had turned red. And he almost killed these two kids running across the street. So I stop into a gas station. He is gassed.
Yeah.
Dude, it's like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Yeah. This isn't like 3 o'clock in the morning. It's like 4 in the afternoon, 5 in the afternoon. And of course, people at the police were like, you got sent to a call. What are you stopping cars for? And I came back. I'd like to defend myself. I'm like, guys, he almost hit two fucking kids running across from the mall. I mean, it's like 12, 13-year-old kids, right? Running across the highway. Because they weren't doing it illegally. And this guy's gassed out of his brains at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So that was just like really, like, I could not believe how drunk this is. He was like a 2.7, dude.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So he was shit-faced and driving and like...
Yeah.
Dude, it would just be... We had a guy... I think the highest BAC I've ever seen was, we had a guy come from the town across the bridge from us.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working. I wasn't a part of it. He had ridden the curb, like, on rims for, like, 5 miles.
Wow. Yeah.
He was literally just letting the curb drive him. And so we went out later. I remember, like, looking at the damage that he had obviously
done to the road.
Yeah,
and
dude, it's wild.
Yeah.
That dude was like a 4-1, some shit like that. It was wild. Like, we was like, dude, that guy, we just got his blood back or whatever. He blew a 4. Like, you know, but he was still like awake at a 4-1.
That's crazy. Yeah. And unfortunately with those, you get the people who are habitual drinkers. And so, yeah, 2 in the afternoon and they are blitzed. And I've seen it. I mean, I think the drunkest that I've personally dealt with is like a 3.6, but a 3.6 is...
That's ridiculous.
That's somebody who... I couldn't even get to a 3.6.
No, you'd be in the hospital.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey guys, follow us on all social media platforms to include Instagram, Twitter, Facebook group. We have so much information going out every single day, and we don't want you to miss out on any of that stuff. So check it out. Go give us a follow.
We had, here's another one. We're coming down a highway. Same intersection, oddly enough. Big town. So same intersection. And I see this car, like, really, like, pinball. And I'm like, we got to stop this one.
Yeah.
I stop the car, come to the car. Bro, this is no bullshit. We had 2 girls driving the car. Legal age to drive in New Jersey, 17.
Okay.
15. Leaving a party, one town over, heading back, like, up the Garden State Parkway into Essex County, which is, like, you obviously don't know this, but they were probably on a trek for about another 30 miles.
Okay.
15. Drunk driving at 15.
Yeah.
And so when their parents came down, I'm like, guys, I know that this seems like a logistical headache when you're going to be going to court and fighting this DWI.
Mm-hmm.
Your daughter's about to get on the Garden State Parkway and do 75, 80 miles an hour.
Right.
Right? Are you, like, you would have had, so as angry as you are at maybe even us or them, like, this is an opportunity for us to intervene and save 100%. Their lives. I never get going to that car. I could feel that night and her giving me a fake name.
Yeah. I had one, I stopped the car. It was, I think it was like the same, like it was, he was speeding. That's what it was. So he was speeding. He was going, I want to say like 80 miles an hour in a 55. It was a construction zone over there. And I go and I stop the car. I go up and it's this kid. And I was like, you cannot be even old enough to drive a car. And I look and he hands me his permit. He was like 16 years old. And I was like, what are you doing driving a car at, you know, it was 2 in the morning or whatever it was. Like, you shouldn't even be out because there's a curfew. And 2, And you could smell the strong odor of burnt marijuana. Like, it was very, very obvious that he'd been smoking. And I pull him over or start doing, you know, the field sobriety stuff and all that. And then we go to the, now we have to go to the hospital because they don't, over where I work, they don't take juveniles until like the hospital clears them for if they're driving under the influence or anything like that. Okay. So then we have to go there, and now I have to call the mom and be like, hey mom, your son's high and driving your car, so figure that out. And it's just to put it into words of the impact that you can have by just arresting or stopping that crime. I don't even know how to, like you said, how to quantify it. Like, there's so many people who, if you stop them before they go and kill somebody, one, you've saved that person because he could have killed himself or herself or whatever. But then you also stop the person from killing whoever it is that they just killed. And what a lot of people don't understand is when somebody kills somebody, it doesn't just affect the person that died. It affects their whole family and their friends and everybody else. So just trying to explain to them, hey, the reason that this crime is so bad is because of this, and then how you stop them, and just explaining all of that. So to have that happen to a 16-year-old, it was shocking. And then I had another one. He was 19, so he was over an adult, legally speaking. So he was drunk. He had gone to a show and then got alcohol because he had like a fake ID or whatever it was. And I arrest him. I get a call from the dad like a week later or something like that. And I got the voicemail because it just goes straight to my voicemail. And I remember listening to the voicemail and he was crying. And he was like, thank you so much for being so nice to my son and for arresting him and all of that stuff. And that just had such an impact.
Tell us about some of the things that you see. I mean, you mentioned it briefly before, what we're doing as a profession, where we're falling short in the convictions of or investigating DUI, crashes, DWI, OUI, OWI. Every state's got a different thing for
them. Yeah, exactly. Different acronym.
And how important is the case law tied to that stuff?
So to answer your first part of the question is the biggest struggle for law enforcement officers that they're coming to with crashes is articulating who the driver is or how he had actual physical control. Because when you get to the crash scene, 9 out of 10 times, they aren't still sitting in the driver's seat of their car. They more likely than not are outside of their car. They're stumbling or walking around or doing whatever. And if you have multiple people in the car, then now you have to do some investigative work. And one of two things typically happens from what I've seen. Number one is either they go, oh, well, can't find the driver or can't figure out who the driver is, so I guess this is over. Or two, they don't do any real like investigative work, or they don't ask questions, they don't talk to people, and so therefore once that happens, it's just pretty much a loss. And then case law, I mean, obviously there's a lot of case law on driving under the influence cases. There's a lot of good Supreme Court cases that came about from it, and I could just think of just a few. I'm blanking on the names right now, but there's a few case laws that were just really, really good for us because of officers who were experienced, who knew how to articulate impairment and how to prove like what the danger is of the action, and then we can win the cases from that. But it just takes somebody taking the time to learn or want to train to get better at it.
There's such an easy way to research the case law on this, and I'll give everybody a clue here. If you go into scholar.google.com, or you can Google Scholar, it'll prompt it. You're going to select your state, and you can actually just input the actual violation that it is. So for New Jersey, it's actually a motor vehicle violation here. Did you know that?
Oh. Yeah.
There's no bail set for it. It's a summons.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, unless there's some kind of accompanying criminal action, mm-hmm. It's not a crime. You don't get fingerprinted for it here.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I don't know how many states are like that, but it's not. There's no bail set, nothing. But if you put in 39:4-50, which is our code for it, inevitably you'd bring up every case where a 450 was referenced. And that's generally what you'd have to sift through a few of these things, but you would find all the cases here. And you know, there's obviously very big debate here. And the debate stems from just no knowledge or not reading it.
Right.
And sometimes the debate I hear is like, well, we didn't actually see them operate the vehicle. I'm like, well, you don't need to see them operate the vehicle.
Correct.
Yeah. Not New Jersey, at least.
Yeah, that's I'd say that's most states, yeah.
Yeah, so you don't need to prove operation in order to prove operation.
Correct.
Yeah. Or charge with a DWI. So you could do that, or you could actually... So we're a DWI here. There's a driving while intoxicated.
Okay.
It's not a DUI.
Yeah.
That's what we use as an acronym. So you could also go in and search DWI or driving while intoxicated. Those three searches, you could actually put them all in the same search bar, right, and it should pull all the results. So,
and there's thousands and thousands of cases.
Probably in the country, but there's probably, I think in most states, maybe 10 cases that everybody needs to be familiar with.
And I would agree, yeah.
And so you're going to run into, as a police officer, a time where you're going to have to pursue charges under a DUI or DWI. And so you need to know what those things say. But it's always so comical because they're like, oh, make sure you read this statement back at police headquarters. Like, okay, why? Like, you know, you can't get them to submit to a breathalyzer or intoxilizer without reading this thing to them. It's the intoxilizer, like, understanding report.
Right.
But it would be good to know, like, where that comes from. Why did that thing get created?
Yeah, the case law behind it.
Yeah.
And there's actually a case in West Virginia that so cop gets called for a job, and he has, so the call is there's a guy laying on the ground ahead of his car. Car's off, not moving, but and in a like a pull off area. So he gets there and the guy's blitzed, hammered, drunk, and so they do a DUI investigation because it's obviously him. He's the only one around. He's the only one who could have been operating that vehicle at some point in time in the recent, near to recent future. And so they do the investigation, and they get the DUI conviction even with no operation. Obviously, the car was off, and he wasn't even... I mean, he was laying in front of his car. He wasn't even anywhere near the driver's seat.
But the pull-off area, the fact that he got there, wasn't like a parking lot.
Yeah.
Right? You had to have gotten to that pull-off area somehow, some way.
Exactly. And that's what a lot of the case law that I've read in regards to this is just proving that they operated the motor or driving or an actual physical control of the motor vehicle at some point in time while under the influence.
Yeah.
So if you the hard part is okay, if you're in a bar parking lot, and then you go up, and because you got called there, you go up and you see somebody passed out behind the wheel of their car. Were they drunk when they pulled up to the bar, or were they drunk from the bar? And so now you have to go into the bar and talk to the person. Hey, did this dude out here drink at all, or did he, you know, did he even come into the place, or you know, is he legally parked? And you know, there's a lot of questions with it. But
we had a bar that was next to a train station. People used to park in the bar parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot. They used to get tickets. And so people would call me. And they were expensive tickets. I forgot what they were. They were like $100-something tickets.
Oh, wow.
So people that I knew would call me and say, like, you know, I got this ticket in this parking lot. I'm like, well, yeah. I mean, I don't think it's a hard defense to argue that you left the vehicle there, wink, wink, because you drank too much the night before.
Yeah.
And that's why the car was parked there. I don't think a judge is going to have a problem with dismissing that ticket because you're using sound judgment to leave your vehicle there.
Right.
You know, I can't emphasize it enough, like how important it is to really, you know, live under the understanding that we're in a time now where you're 5 minutes away from a Lyft or an Uber.
100%.
What does a DUI typically cost people?
Well, in my state, a DUI can range anywhere from, I mean, by the end of it, $2,000 to $5,000, depending on the circumstance, because if you on a first offense, yeah, you're looking at least $2,000, not to mention your time, because you have to go to the victim impact panel, you have to go to classes in regards to your issues with alcohol or drugs, so a substance abuse class, you have to do to get your license back, now you have to go through a another thing to, or a breathalyzer machine in your car, or you have to fight it to get your license back somehow. It's a long process where you could just Uber for $20.
What is somebody going to learn in your training course, and why should they come?
So one of the main things that I teach is how to articulate impairment, how to show impairment to somebody who has no clue what impairment actually means, and then how to piece it all together as it relates to drug impairment, because there's a big disconnect. So back when DUIs were first taught, and back in the 70s when all the case law, or I mean when all the case studies and all of that stuff for standardized field sobriety tests came about, everybody was teaching it, and they were teaching it alcohol only. And they're like, all right, alcohol, 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 alcohol. Well, now we're in 2023 where the drug use is astronomical, and you have people more under the influence of drugs than anything else. And so how to use the training that you have already had to prove impairment as it relates to drugs, and then how to write all of that stuff into a report in a way that actually makes sense. Because I've, and I'm sure you have too, read reports where I had a trainee one time where I read his report and I was like, hey dude, I was there with you and I'm confused. So that's not going to work. Like, we have to write reports in a way that actually makes sense, that actually summarizes, or that actually has all of the elements of the crime. And that's the stuff that I teach.
One thing I thought about before that I think would be good for bringing up for this podcast episode was, people also typically ask, like, are you allowed to ask people questions on the side of the road about their impairment?
Mm-hmm.
Would you need Miranda rights?
So there's actually a lot of case law about it, but there's a Supreme Court case.
Birkenbeer v. McCarty. It's Birkenbeer v. McCarty.
Yep. And you do not need Miranda for interview, interviewing for anything as relates to DUI investigations, because you're doing an investigation. You're not in custody interrogation, so you don't need Miranda.
Right. So yeah, and there's a case in New Jersey called Birkenitis. It comes out of Seaside Heights, and they cite Birkenbeer v. McCarty in New Jersey. So if you would have searched Birkenbeer v. McCarty in Google Scholar, you would come up with probably the first result you get here. But essentially, roadside questioning of a motorist suspected of DWI or DUI is not constitute Miranda on the side of the road. So you can ask somebody, what have you drank? How much have you had to drink? You're doing your investigation. There's not full-blown custody. Yes, they are lawfully detained, but doesn't mean they're actually in custody in the eyes of Miranda being necessary.
Correct.
To conduct the investigation.
And there's actually case law, too. It's, I'm probably going to butcher the name, but Pennsylvania v. Munes. And in that case, they talk about doing field sobriety tests after they are already in custody and in the, like, at the jail, and they found that the field sobriety tests in and of themselves you can do without Miranda, because it's not testimonial evidence.
Right.
You're having them do an action. Now, if you're going to ask questions, obviously you have to have Miranda once they're in custody, but beforehand, if it's just on a traffic stop or a crash or whatever, you don't need it.
What are some pieces of advice in closing that you would give people who are interested in pursuing a career combating DUIs and DWIs?
The best advice that I can give is that you take the time to learn. Well, first is what's it going to take to get the conviction in your state, because every state works a little bit different on what they need elements of crime wise, and then taking the training that you need to get experience in everything that's related to it, because there's so much different training that you can do. There's A-Ride and DRE, and then obviously, like, my class is a good blend between everything, because when you are looking at 100 hours of training or 120 hours of training, that can be taxing. And so if you are just interested in doing it, or you want to get involved in this game, then my class is really a good foundation to help and see if that's something that you're going to want to pursue even further, and then go down the road of, like, DRE training.
That's cool. And where can they find your training? StreetCop.com,
yep.
Right? If people have questions about your class, how can they reach you? What's your email address? Don't say your cell phone number. You're crazy.
they can reach me at Zachary Schlater at StreetCop.com.
Awesome, man. Well, I appreciate it, brother. I know you got to get on the road in about 5 minutes or so. Appreciate Zach for being here today.
For sure. Thanks.
Hey guys, check out our upcoming training at streetcop.com. Don't forget, we have 50 instructors nationally teaching a variety of topics. These are the best classes you're going to experience in your career. We make sure of it. You're going to love it. I guarantee you, you're going to be thankful that you went. Check us out at streetcop.com for all upcoming classes in your area.